This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, it can be tough to have good conversations about difficult topics like race, gender, and identity, but it can be done. Get some advice with the authors of the new book, Say the Right Thing. Now, after Tuesday night's State of the Union address, President Biden stopped in Wisconsin yesterday. He talked to a crowd of Democratic Party officials, donors, and dozens of union members at a worker training center in DeForest. The president's message was focused on the economy, workers, and the middle class.
Through the American Rescue Plan, we're funding workforce development programs, including $128 million here in Wisconsin, dollars in Wisconsin, so American workers are prepared to compete in the economy we're building. This is a blue-collar blueprint to rebuild America.
In her response to the president's State of the Union address, Arkansas Governor Sarah Huckabee Sanders painted a different picture of the American economy.
In the radical left's America, Washington taxes you and lights your hard-earned money on fire. But you get crushed with high gas prices, empty grocery shelves, and our children are taught to hate one another.
Our next guest is here to help us better understand the competing claims about the economy as well as the fiscal policies that could make a difference in our personal finances. You can join in at 800-642-1234. How does the economy look to you? What factors matter to your family's budget? What's your job situation like, your prospects right now? We've seen low unemployment numbers. Is that changing your work or the workers you try to hire? How is inflation affecting you? Are you seeing the impact? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Menzie Chin is a professor of public affairs and economics at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Menzie, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me back, Rob.
Well, I want to look at the president looking at the jobs numbers and his critics looking at inflation numbers. Let's start with jobs, some pretty big numbers and low numbers when it comes to unemployment. What is the latest you're looking at on the employment scene, Menzie?
Well, I think the latest numbers were very surprising. You know, 517,000 jobs is big. By any standards, much in excess, something like three times what economists had been expecting. And that's already on top of a market that looked like it was bubbling along pretty well, very tight, with even the previous estimates of job growth were moved upwards in a big revision that occurs once a year. So on jobs, we seem to have an economy that's moving along very well, perhaps in some ways so well that some people on Wall Street and so forth are afraid that the Federal Reserve might say, well, this is a sign of an overheated economy. On the other hand, average wage increases didn't show up as being particularly fast. So to the extent that wage increases feed into inflation, we might have some hope there, and maybe we shouldn't be expecting as much inflation. That's the current state of debate, at least on jobs.
Now, if I'm a president, and that probably won't happen, but if I am the president and job numbers look good like that, I'm going to try to take credit. Can you connect the dots between White House policies and or things that Democrats in Congress and the president pass that could be contributing to our current state of affairs when it comes to jobs?
Well, that's an excellent question. I mean, it's a tenuous link between any given policy that the White House can implement on its own and what happens to the macroeconomy. And then there are always these lags that confuse people's ability to detect the linkages. I would say, however, in the past 2 years, the president and the Congress have passed this set of bills, the bipartisan infrastructure bill, the Inflation Reduction Act. Those things, particularly the bipartisan infrastructure bill, I mean, they're pumping money into the economy of a sort that's probably less inflationary, more measured over time than some of the other measures that have passed. And so some of that spending certainly hasn't started, but the mere anticipation that some of those funds are coming along probably helps support optimism. And to the extent that you've got a pretty stable fiscal policy so far, that is, the president and the Congress aren't fighting interminably over which way to raise taxes, lower taxes, or over a debt ceiling so far, that stability has added to, I think, people's willingness, firms' willingness to hire and invest.
Yesterday, the president, speaking at that training center for the Laborers International Union in North America in DeForest, made a point of highlighting organized labor in particular.
For the first time in a long time, we're building an economy from the bottom up and the middle out. The bottom up and the middle out. With products made in America, with union labor. Not labor, union labor.
Okay, so the president yesterday pointing toward, I think, manufacturing to an extent and manufacturing job increases that would benefit organized labor in particular. Are you seeing that happening?
Well, I think it's clear that the president has implemented a set of policies that are in some ways trying to support manufacturing. Certainly the bipartisan infrastructure bill is putting funds into activities, construction, and so forth that are blue collar. The Inflation Reduction Act has all these tax credits and rebates and so forth that will probably give incentives to greater investment, which will employ workers. Hopefully a whole bunch of them will be middle class and, you know, unionized. Other policies include the continuation of some tariffs, the tariffs that were placed on Chinese goods, for instance, and on aluminum and steel. There's a debate whether that is actually supportive on net of all union jobs. It certainly probably helps narrowly defined steel and aluminum worker jobs, which are unionized, but might have a negative impact on the rest of the economy in terms of employment. So certainly you've got that. You've got the sort of verbal support for unions. I think the gains in terms of union leverage, in terms of workers' leverage, has been largely due to the fact that we've got this very tight labor market. I don't want to minimize the effect of the president's support, but if I were to try to detect how the bargaining has shifted between labor and companies, I think a lot of it has exactly to do with the fact that there's a tight labor market and supply is less than it used to be, and demand is high.
Talking to UW-Madison economist Menzi Chin about the latest on the U.S. jobs picture, inflation, and more, and political claims for credit or blame. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a question about the state of the U.S. economy, the Wisconsin economy? What would you want the government to focus on, if anything, that you think would boost the economy? What do you need? What would help you? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. In response to the president's visit, we heard the chairman of the Wisconsin Republican Party, Brian Schimming, put out a statement yesterday. Here's an excerpt. Quote, Wisconsin households and businesses have faced crushing inflation, decreasing real wages, and increasing energy bills for months. And trying to buy votes with his inflationary spending and Green New Deal agenda isn't the answer to helping Wisconsin families. Menzi, let's turn to the inflation side of things now. We saw inflation, I think, peak over the last year or so, highest level since, the early 1980s or so. What is the latest on our measures of inflation now?
What's true is year on year, inflation was 6.4% over, 2022. But that's kind of looking backwards. Over much shorter time span, let's say 3 months, what you can see is inflation is decelerating quite rapidly. And as a consequence, what we have is the forecasts are something like 3% inflation for 2023. So I think what we can say is for sure inflation is, for the moment, decelerating.
Now, if I'm the party not in the White House and I see high inflation, I'm, of course, going to want to try to connect the dots, saying that guy's policies are what's causing a lot of this inflation. Are there things you see, again, from the White House and from bills passed by Democrats in Congress over the last couple of years that may have, at least in part, contributed to the higher inflation levels?
Definitely some of the responses in the past have added to or contributed to the inflation we're seeing now. I mean, it's important to recall the context. We closed down the economy in 2020 for several months, 2 months to be, shortened up in the statistics. And that, what did that do? That reduced demand, but it also reallocated demand to goods. We reopened the economy, but people were still wary of going out and being in public and going to restaurants and so forth. So what did that do in turn? That meant that we had disproportionate spending on goods and a limited supply and capacity to bring in goods from the rest of the world. So, I mean, the confluence of those two things, it means that you had this burst of inflation. We sort of like hit the wall in terms of what we could supply in goods. And that demand was in part supported by funds in both the packages passed under the Trump administration and then the act passed under the Biden administration in the first few months. So surely those things added something to the demand, so the pressure. But don't forget, we had all this congestion in the ports and infrastructure log jams. We had the shortage of semiconductor chips, and we had the resurgence of oil prices, which then were redoubled when the invasion of Ukraine was expanded. So between the two, what we have is a set of both supply and demand factors, only part of which is directly attributable to the activities of or the proposals of the administration.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Pat is with us in Green Bay. Hi, Pat.
Good afternoon, and thank you for taking my call.
What did you want to bring up?
It's actually twofold. Number one, when are the politicians going to stop their silly bickering back and forth? It's this group's fault. It's that group's fault. When are they going to start doing what they're supposed to be doing and working for us? And then the other thing, please, these people that sit there and they chirp about the high price of fuel and everything else, but when you look at the corporate earnings, they're in the billions of dollars.
Pat, thanks for the call. Let's go to that second point. Betsy, I don't know if you're going to solve the partisan divide here for the first part, but corporate profits, Pat, and others are saying, well, wait a minute, we're paying a lot of inflation, but we're seeing from oil companies, I think in particular, some big numbers when it comes to their annual revenue and profits.
Well, absolutely. Each time there's a surge in oil prices, then you see temporarily, at least, that the oil companies make sort of essentially windfall profits. Their profits jump up a lot, essentially because, you know, they've already invested and sunk expenditures in. Suddenly they find great demand for their product, and the demand is inelastic. That is, it's not very responsive to prices. And so in order to have, you know, the supply being matched up with the quantity demanded, the price adjusts a lot, and boom, you get lots of big profits for the oil companies. Now, if I'm talking about inflation, inflation is not just high prices; it's the continuation of prices rising over time. And so, there, you know, part of that is just, you know, supply and demand having an impact. So, you know, as long as even if we didn't have the oil companies, you know, raising prices tremendously, they would still be raising prices as there was scarcity. And so the concern is that, you know, there's these underlying forces that are pushing up prices and hence inflation.
Pat, thanks for that call. Menzi Chin is with us, professor of public affairs and economics at UW-Madison, with us to look at the claims politicians make about the economy and help us follow the economic indicators that matter. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. How is the economy treating you these days? Have you seen a public policy that you think helped or hurt you in some way at in your line of work, in your daily shopping? Call in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts, your experiences, your solutions, or your questions. That's 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk now with Menzi Chin, professor of public affairs and economics at UW-Madison, looking at the president's visit to Wisconsin yesterday, the various claims that political leaders are making about the state of our economy. Still time for your call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Back to your calls now. Tom is with us in Oshkosh. Hi, Tom.
Hi. My question is, with the low unemployment rate, how does that correlate to the very unreported labor participation rate, and how does the labor participation rate today compare to 5 years ago and maybe 15 or 20 years ago?
Tom, thanks for the call. Great question, Menzie. The labor participation or workforce participation rate, a measure that Tom says we don't often see in the headlines.
Well, that's an excellent point. I mean, you have to understand that the unemployment rate is a function of, you know, you're looking at how many people categorize themselves to the extent that the statisticians are happy with as being unemployed, as divided by the labor force, where the labor force is, you know, the people who are employed plus defined as actively searching for a job. And that has certain requirements of you having applied for several number of jobs. So that calculation of the labor force might not necessarily take into account discouraged workers or the workers who have dropped out of the labor force for, let's say, health reasons. And I think that is one of the factors that people have been looking at over the past year or so in tracking the evolution of the labor market. So, yes, the unemployment rate is quite low, but we're probably missing out on some other aspects. And the caller is right. The labor force participation rate is down. And I think some of it has been attributed to, among other things, more people have retired than you would have expected ordinarily in the past year and a half or so. And then there's some evidence that illness, and here we might say the longstanding illnesses that are associated with COVID, have taken a lot of people out of the labor force. So the labor market is tight partly because of the, you know, the enhanced demand that we have from some of the stimulus packages and recovery packages of the past. But some of it is also the fact that, you know, some people have decided to exit the labor market because they're either ill or they just, it's not worth it. I'm close enough to retirement, too hard to find a new job in this new reconfigured economy.
Tom, thanks for that call. Rich joins us now in Delavan. Rich, hi.
Hey, good afternoon. Thank you very much for taking my call, and I really love what you're doing with your show. Just a comment about government spending. You know, we have a problem getting both parties to agree on a $3 trillion relief bill for infrastructure work that this company or country desperately needs. But when we were overseas in Iraq and Afghanistan, spending billions upon trillions of dollars, that was basically a carte blanche, and nobody ever complained about that. And as a former service member who did two tours in Iraq, you know, it's kind of disgusting to see that the amount of money that was spent over there, and we can't even get politicians to agree on, you know, actually improving this country from a financial perspective.
Rich, thanks a lot for the call. I appreciate that. Menzie, it's an interesting point, distinguishing between the impact on inflation and the future economy between, you know, big investments in military spending for a war in Iraq or Afghanistan versus maybe the same amount of money going into infrastructure development in the United States. Can you talk about that a little?
Oh, yes, sure. I think that's an excellent point to be brought up. And I'll just mention, first of all, we did pass a bipartisan infrastructure bill. And that was actually to the amount of $1.2 trillion. Now, $1.2 trillion over the course of 5 years. So it's not every year that you're getting that amount. But that's a substantial package. And I think that was something that many, many, many economists of all stripes could get behind, because we know that first, infrastructure investment has a big multiplier. For each dollar you put into infrastructure spending, you get probably a in total is something like a $1.6 increase in GDP, which so that number is like a lot bigger than, say, for spending on consumption otherwise, let's say civil servants. Now, to the fact that about defense spending versus you know, infrastructure investment, I'm 100% behind that. I mean, you know, if you're spending on tanks and you're spending on building fortresses or camps in overseas, that's not going to directly enhance your GDP or your productive capacity in the future. It shows up in GDP, but it won't show up in, you know, how many widgets you can build next year. Whereas if I'm investing in infrastructure, you're going to be able to move things around more quickly. People will get cleaner water. If you're investing in broadband, more people can access the internet. And, you know, if you've ever have to fought to get some a good internet connection. You can imagine what gains you could get in productivity once we are connected effectively. So I would say, yes, I mean, that's what people have been saying for a long time. We need more infrastructure investment. And that's one of the achievements of the past couple of years. And, you know, if somebody had asked me beforehand whether it would have gotten done, I would have been dubious, but it did get, get done. There are other investments that are being undertaken, and it's harder to figure out what the returns will be. So we have the Inflation Reduction Act, which is like $400 to $800 billion worth of tax credits. And, you know, we're hopeful that that spurs some investment in green technologies. I'm not aware of, you know, any definitive studies of what the multiplier is for that. And we also have the CHIPS package, which is, I believe it's like $280 billion worth of investment in semiconductor chip factories. And we'll have to wait and see, you know, whether those investments pan out. They sound like good ideas, and they probably will have positive benefits for the economy, but it's harder to define how big they'll be.
Thanks a lot for that call. And Menzi, we'll leave it there. Thanks, as always, for joining us today.
My pleasure. Good to be here.
That's Menzi Chin, professor of public affairs and economics at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. He joined us this afternoon with a look at the partisan divide over economic policy and the effect those policies have on us and our economy in general. We take some big picture looks at the economy like that. I love them. Is there something on your mind when it comes to our economy, big or small? Something you've always been curious about? Something that you think affects your life that you don't hear talked about much in the media? We'd love to hear from you, and maybe that'll set up a future conversation here on Central Time. You can always email ideas@WPR.org. That's ideas@WPR.org. Let us know what you want to hear us talking about when it comes to Wisconsin's economy, the American economy, and beyond. ideas@WPR.org. Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show with Kate Archer-Kent, learn how to take care of your muscles and your bones. It's the latest installment of health advice and science in ongoing Body Week on The Morning Show. If you missed some of the earlier discussions, some brain science along the way, heart health and gut health, find them in our archives at WPR.org and then join the muscle and bone conversation. It's coming up tomorrow morning at 8. Check it out here on the Ideas Network or at WPR.org. It's Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up today at 6 on 1A Plus, fossil hunting is hot, from deserts that were once ocean floors to the urban jungle. What's driving what some are calling America's new bone rush? Find out more today at 6 on 1A Plus. Now, hey, do you have a minute? I want to have a one-on-one conversation with you about race and gender and sexual orientation and mistakes we might make when we talk about those things. Okay, your heart rate might have gone up a bit there. You might think, am I going to say something that offends lots of people? Is this going to be a painful, difficult conversation? Is Rob going to say something cringeworthy? If just thinking about these kind of talks makes you uncomfortable, you're not alone. It can be easier to not have these conversations at all. But hang on. Our next guests say it's important to talk about these topics, and they have a lot of advice to help have good conversations, and they have a lot of experience and research to back it up. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you had a difficult conversation with friends, coworkers, classmates, family, or others about issues related to race or gender, sexual orientation, other issues of identity? What went poorly? What went well? What do you wish you'd done differently? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Kenji Yoshino and David Glasgow are professors at the New York University School of Law, where they run the Meltzer Center for Diversity, Inclusion, and Belonging. Their new book is called Say the Right Thing: How to Talk About Identity, Diversity, and Justice. David, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
And Kenji, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having me.
Kenji, I think, as I just said, sometimes the easiest path is to not talk about these issues of identity so much. A huge part of your book is making the case that, yeah, it is important. It's worth the effort. Convince people who might be skeptical.
Yes, absolutely. So, you know, the first case to be made is that silence is no longer viewed to be neutrality. I think silence in many quarters is viewed to be complicity and an unjust status quo. And so simply remaining on the sidelines is not an option. just for the kind of blowback that you might receive from individuals who need you in these conversations. And then in a more uplifting way, I think that we all have values as individuals who want to create a more inclusive society for all, to stand up for those values. And we're not going to be able to do that if we are so frozen in fear that we opt out of these conversations or run away from them.
And David, I think one response people might have, I'll throw me out there as an example. I'm white, male, and straight. And somebody in my position might say, if I have this conversation with somebody who doesn't meet one of those categories, I'm going to be blamed for something. I'm going to be the bad guy. I'm going to be made to feel shame. How do you try to assure people that it doesn't have to be that way?
Well, we specifically wrote this book to be shame-free. We don't like shaming approaches to these conversations. In fact, one of the core principles that we're trying to get across in our book is to shift people in emphasis away from cancel culture toward what we call coaching culture. That is, rather than just shaming and blaming people who make mistakes in these conversations, we really want to wrap our arms around people and give them practical tools for how to have these conversations more effectively, like a coach would, so that you don't get ostracized, but rather you're given the skills like how to apologize, how to disagree, how to build curiosity, resilience, all of the practical tools you need to have these conversations effectively.
Okay, Kenji, shame-free, but not necessarily easy. There can be some discomfort in these conversations, and you use the phrase in the book, the democratization of discomfort. What do you mean by that?
Yeah, so there's a certain amount of discomfort that is kind of par for the course for these conversations. And I think one of the things that we have to realize is that if these conversations have seemed more comfortable, right, prior to the last, say, 5 or 10 years, it's not that the discomfort hasn't been there, it's that the discomfort has been entirely borne by the other party to the conversation. So that if I'm having a conversation about gender with a woman sort of 20 years ago, it might mean that the conversation is acutely uncomfortable for her, but totally comfortable for me. And one of the things that's changed in the last 20 years is that when we have those conversations, that woman might have higher expectations of what kinds of behavior and understanding she expects from me. And I might experience that in turn as a form of discomfort, because now the discomfort is being shared between us. She's not assuming the full burden of that, and it's more fairly distributed across the two of us. So oftentimes people come to us and they say, like, oh my gosh, like, why was that conversation so uncomfortable? It was like, you know, fingers on a chalkboard. I was like dying to get out of that room. And our response is to say, maybe that's the wrong question. Maybe the question isn't, why is this conversation so uncomfortable? But rather, why has it been so comfortable until now? And oftentimes the answer is because the other side, the non-dominant side of the conversation, has been bearing the brunt of that discomfort until this point.
If I'm criticized for anything, I'm human, a particular kind of human, I can get defensive. And my initial response isn't necessarily going to be great. And you two write that in these conversations about race and identity, when somebody's, you know, called on something they may have done wrong or that made somebody uncomfortable, their defensive reactions can be in a handful of categories: avoid, deflect, deny, attack. We may not have time to go into all of them in detail, but how do we check that initial response to, I don't know, to fight back or just run away from this conversation?
Yeah, as you say, you know, avoid, deflect, deny, and attack are the most common responses that we see. And you can think of avoid and deflect a little bit like flight in a fight or flight response. So you're running away from the conversation, whereas deny and attack are the fight mode. That's where you're standing in the conversation, but you're pushing back hard on the other person, and in some cases making it quite personal and attacking them. And so we think that the key skill, or one of the key skills to develop to overcome these ADDA behaviors, is resilience. So building the kind of emotional stamina and strength to be able to persist in these conversations despite the overwhelming discomfort that you may feel. And so one of the tools that we offer in the book is to give people the ability to adopt a growth mindset. It's very common in these conversations that when you make a mistake, you think about it as a reflection of your innate moral character. So that must mean I'm a terrible person, I'm a racist, I'm a sexist, what have you. What we want people to do instead is move to what the psychologist Carol Dweck calls a growth mindset, meaning that you respond to a mistake as an opportunity to learn. So if I make a mistake when I'm playing the piano, I don't think that makes me a terrible person. I just think I need to practice more to improve the next time. And we want to give people the tools to be able to take that same attitude of growth mindset into this arena of conversations about identity.
Talking to David Glasgow and Kenji Yoshino about their new book, Say the Right Thing, How to Talk About Identity, Diversity, and Justice. You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. If you feel uncomfortable doing that, I totally understand. But if you have an anecdote to share, a question for a guest, we would love to hear from you at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Kenji, something David just said reminded me of an anecdote later in your book when you're talking about, you know, when you see somebody else, maybe a family member or someone saying something. The example is, I think it was a woman. Her uncle said something about, I think, Mexican immigrants, a disparaging remark. Her approach was really interesting. It wasn't, why would you say that? It was, I know you're a good person. I know you would like run into a burning building and save someone. You wouldn't ask about their immigration status. Can you talk about that kind of approach to checking someone on that?
Yes, it's actually a beautiful connection that you're drawing there, because one might say, okay, I can have all the growth mindset in the world, but I'm still going to be afraid, because even if I'm compassionate towards myself when I make a mistake, other people might not be compassionate right. towards me, and they might cancel me. And oftentimes that's what we're really afraid of. So we make a huge point in the book about saying that part of being a good ally in these conversations is being an ally, not just to the person who's been harmed, but also to the source of non-inclusive behavior. And what we mean by that is that when somebody messes up, you know, our first instinct might be to pile onto that person, but we have to understand that that's all of us. It's not a question of whether we're going to make a mistake. It's a question of when we will make that mistake. And so it behooves us to be compassionate and kind and to help people of goodwill grow past the mistakes that we're making. So it's really the flip side of the growth mindset that David was talking about. The glorious story that you mentioned comes from the wonderful Loretta Ross, a scholar up at Smith, who talks about how we need to stop calling people out and start calling people in. And so what she says to the uncle who makes this opprobrious comment about immigrants is to actually affirm him as a person, saying, I know you, Uncle Frank. I know you're an incredible human being. If there was a burning building, you would rush in to save it. And you wouldn't care if the person in that building was gay or an immigrant or what have you. So please help me reconcile the incredibly loving, wonderful Uncle Frank, whom I know you to be, with the words that just came out of your mouth. And that, we think, is a wonderful way to approach somebody, because it's not just like hate the sin, not the sinner. It's affirm the person, right? You know, bring the person back into it and say, you know, you're a wonderful human being. Help me understand how that conduct or that comment was consistent, right, with the ideals that I know that that human being has.
We're talking to Kenji Yoshino and David Glasgow about their new book. It's called Say the Right Thing, How to Talk About Identity, Diversity, and Justice. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you seen this kind of conversation maybe around a family dinner table in a workplace diversity training? What went well, do you think? What was painful? Painful in a good way or just bad? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We continue our talk with Kenji Yoshino and David Glasgow about their new book, Say the Right Thing, How to Talk About Identity, Diversity, and Justice. A lot of practical advice for having difficult, potentially difficult conversations. If you're willing to share an experience or a question, you can join in at 800-642-1234. Or you need some advice on how to have this kind of conversation and how to approach it. Call it at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. David, we've heard a few of your principles on, you know, how to have good, productive conversations. I want to check out another one now, cultivate curiosity. How do we do that, and how do we use it to benefit ourselves when we're talking about these issues of identity?
So we point out in our chapter on curiosity that oftentimes when we show up to these conversations from the more dominant group side, so as a white person, if I'm entering a conversation about race, or as someone who doesn't have a disability, if I'm entering a conversation about disability, we often enter those conversations where with a lot of knowledge that we lack. So if I'm speaking with someone who uses a wheelchair, I won't know necessarily about where the curb cuts and ramps are in my neighborhood or what kinds of biases or barriers that people with disabilities encounter as they go about their lives. Whereas the person that I'm speaking with often will know that information or at least know it a lot better than I will. And so we think it's really important for people like me in that conversation to be humble as we enter those conversations about the areas where we lack knowledge and to listen generously to the perspective of the person that we're speaking to and respect the extra knowledge that that person likely brings into the conversation. And so a couple of techniques for doing that. One is just do some research. I mean, you're never going to be able to fully understand what it's like to belong to a different social group than your own, but you can do a lot of ordinary research, like listening to podcasts or reading books or reading articles about the experience of people from other groups. And then when you're actually in a conversation with someone, we think it's really important to share your own perspective in the conversation tentatively and listen generously to the other person. So when you're sharing your own perspective, rather than making statements of definitive fact as though you know everything there is to know, you might instead use I statements. So say things like, I wonder, I feel, I think, and even explicitly say to the person that you're offering your perspective with that humility. So you might say, this is a draft, so please edit it, things like that.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Celia is with us in Madison. Celia, hi.
Hi, how you doing? I appreciate you and your speakers very much. I used to teach communications as a consultant, and I agree 100% with what they're saying, that if somebody has said something or acted out in some way, discuss a behavior or the words as soon as possible so you don't drift into you're a bad person. And since we're only supposed to be facilitators, we couldn't tell people what to do. So what we finally fell back on was asking the person, well, what would you say are the consequences of what you just did or said? So they teach themselves.
Celia, interesting. Thanks for sharing that experience. Kenji, the two of you work a lot in the business world. What do you think of Celia's approach?
I really love it. And I really appreciate the call as well. You know, one of the things that this highlights is the distinction between intent and impact that we often focus on. So, you know, oftentimes when we're having these conversations and someone calls us out or tries to call us in on something, we immediately deflect, to go back to our earlier conversation, to our good intentions, right? And so we channel switch and we say, well, my intent was really good, and so therefore you should give me a pass. And one of the things that, like Celia, we urge people to do is to focus not on their own intent, but focus on the impact that the action or the comment might have had on the other person. Because if you focus on impact, you know, that's much more likely to get at the nub of what is bothering the other person. I can have all the good intent in the world and have stepped on your foot by accident, you know, but it doesn't take away any of the pain that I've caused. And so keeping the frame steadily on the consequences of the actions, on the impact of the action rather than your own intent, is a really good practice.
Celia, thanks again for that call at 800-642-1234. David, Celia brings up a situation that is, I guess, reactive. Something has happened. We're dealing with it now. Is there a way for a business or school or whatever institution is to create, I don't know, I guess an environment where you can avoid some of those incidents or have that framework for dealing with them from the get-go?
Absolutely. And we think that a really critical concept in this area is called allyship, which may be familiar to some of your listeners, which is the idea that all of us, no matter what demographic group we belong to, have a role to play to build that kind of inclusive culture. And we have worked with a lot of organizations that have really tried to embed that concept of allyship into their organization through education, research, training, and the way that they talk about diversity and inclusion issues inside their organizations. Because the idea behind allyship is a really simple one, which is that when you witness, you know, non-inclusive behavior, or even before witnessing non-inclusive behavior, you can show up to these conversations enacting a lot of the principles that we describe in the book by displaying resilience and curiosity, by disagreeing respectfully, by apologizing authentically. And by doing that at the outset, we hope that a lot of the kinds of incidents that we've been describing can be avoided if people have adopted those principles at the outset.
Talking to David Glasgow and Kenji Yoshino about their new book. It's called Say the Right Thing, How to Talk About Identity, Diversity, and Justice. Kenji, there'll be a portion of the audience listening who hears the words identity and diversity has a framework on that where that says, yeah, I'm going to tune out now. This is an attack on people who are white or male, or the list goes on. And we're seeing that in the political world, certainly. What would you say to reach out to them and try to bring them into the conversation?
I would say that, you know, there are people who, you know, are just ideologically opposed to the project of a more inclusive society, and that those individuals should have their opinions respected, but also should kind of be left alone. So one of our great colleagues, Dolly Chug here at NYU, a psychologist, says D&I, like many other things, diversity inclusion, that is, obeys a 20-60-20 rule, where 20% are just unbelievably, you know, for it, they're champions, 20% are ideologically opposed to it. And then most people are in that 60% in the movable middle. So I think when people sort of have this allergy to diversity and inclusion, you first need to figure out where they sit, whether they're in the kind of opposed 20%, in which case just leave them alone. They're entitled to their opinion. They're not going to move any more than I'm going to move from my commitments to diversity and inclusion. But if you're talking to that middle 60%, it's really important to meet the concerns of that middle 60%, because oftentimes what I feel like is that I'm standing at one end of a room and say, like, Ron DeSantis or Sarah Huckabee Sanders come to mind as people who have recently come out against diversity and inclusion initiatives. We're standing at the other end of the room. And so we're, you know, totally at loggerheads. We're not going to persuade each other, but we're talking to the people in the middle of the room and trying to get them to come to our side. And what I would say to the person who's in the middle, who's undecided about how they feel about diversity and inclusion issues, is, can you actually allow us to challenge ourselves as the people who want to convince you that D&I has a great value proposition in terms of creating a more equitable, a more just, a more inclusive society, to sort of change tacks? Because I think too often, again, we've been talking to you in terms of this fear-based rhetoric of, if you make one mistake, you'll get canceled. And of course, the more we talk about canceling people or hurting people when they make, you know, genuine good faith mistakes, the more the other side looks more attractive, because the other side is saying, say whatever you want. And then if you disagree, if other people disagree with you, then you can just call them crazy and denigrate them. So what we want to say instead, again, going back to the point about moving from cancel culture to coaching culture, is we want to put an arm around the people in the middle and to say, you have these ideals that are really worth fighting for, of a more inclusive, egalitarian society. We are a more diverse society, so these conversations are, you know, inescapable. But what we want to do for you is not to shame you. We want to hold you to very, very high standards, right? But we're not going to shame you in reaching them. We're going to actually give you all the support that you need, and we're going to give you actual skills, which cancel culture emphatically does not, in order to have these conversations so that you can have guardrails, right, around you, so that the degree to which you'll fail or your likelihood of success, right, change, right? Your degree of failure is going to be much smaller. Your likelihood of success is going to be much greater. And I think that one of the mistakes that people in the D&I community have made with the best of intentions is to lean into the kind of punitive aspects of diversity and inclusion and not lean into the kind of more joyful, skill-based, you know, this is about human flourishing aspects of diversity and inclusion.
And David, with just a half a minute, one piece of advice you give in the book, useful to all of us, a tip for making a good apology.
Yeah, so we think apologies are actually fairly simple because they follow the four R's of recognition, responsibility, remorse, and redress. So first, recognize the harm. Second, take responsibility for causing the harm. Third, show remorse. So be sincere in your expression of contrition. And then fourth, give some redress. So actually take action to back up your words so that it's not just all talk.
We'll leave it there. David, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much.
And Kenji, thanks for being with us today.
What a great conversation. Thank you.
I've been talking to Kenji Yoshino and David Glasgow. Their new book is called Say the Right Thing, How to Talk About Identity, Diversity, and Justice. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, an author shares stories of people dealing with a diagnosis of mental illness and how they shape their identities in moments of crisis in the new book, Strangers to Ourselves. And it's this week's edition of Food Friday. Well, it's winter. I don't know if you noticed. And sometimes you want your food to give you that splash of sunshine. We're going to brighten up our winter meals with some citrus flavor. I've been doing this more and more lately. Really looking forward to this conversation. That and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time.